Welcome to the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. We feature hot topics and novel perspectives, always with relevance to the dental career and practice. Join our hosts, Anina and Elena, as they speak with new guests from around the world each month and learn more about what's important for the next generation in oral regeneration.
Hello, everyone, and here we are with a new episode of the Next Regeneration Podcast. So I don't know about you, Anina, but after dedicating months and months on a research project and after analyzing and interpreting the data, writing a manuscript and seeing it published is something that I find extremely rewarding. And so today's episode is exactly about this. So about the importance of publishing your scientific work and reflecting on which aspects we should consider. What do you think, Anina? How do you feel when you finally get your work published?
Oh, yes, Elena, I completely agree with you. It's a great feeling to submit your manuscript and also to see it finally published. There's something very rewarding about that. To discuss this topic further, I'm very pleased that Professor Sasha Ivanovsky has taken the time to be with us today. Professor Ivanovsky is the Dean at the University of Queensland, School of Dentistry, and a newly elected member of the board of the Osteology Foundation. During his impressive academic career, he has published more than 250 articles, several book chapters, and the conference papers. So we are very happy that he is here today to share his experience and knowledge with us. Dear Sasha, we welcome you to our podcast.
Thank you, Anina, for this very kind introduction. And thank you to both of you for the invitation to speak on this very important topic.
Well, thank you for joining us. Yeah, exactly. So I believe that the main reason for publishing is, or at least should be, to advance and expand the knowledge in our field of interest. However, another important reason is definitely to gain credit and recognition from the published work. And in particular for academics, there is this growing need to have a certain number of publications in order to enhance the scientific profile or even to apply for promotion or to be able to apply for funding, like, for instance, for large grants. So, Professor Ivanovsky, how do you see this trend going forward? And what do you think about the real reasons that motivate researchers to publish?
Look, this is a great question, Elena. And I think to answer this question, we really need to think about why we publish. I mean, what is this whole concept of publishing and where does it come from? And if we really reflect on this, I think it's clear that one of the key aspects that underpins the dissemination of knowledge and the exchange of scientific knowledge is the concept of peer review. And this has been the case for many years. And now this is where really publishing is critical, and the link to the between publishing and the peer review process is really important. So this really then puts publications very much at the center of the dissemination of knowledge. So as you said, so the main reason we publish is to disseminate knowledge. This is really the critical really consideration as researchers, as scientists, as academics. Indeed, one can say that if you haven't published, then this work doesn't really exist in the scientific domain, and then you don't really have any recognition for this work that you've spent, as you say, sometimes months and even longer to prepare. Mm-hmm. So then comes the career aspect, of course. So I mean, this is again linked to the authenticity of your research and your approach towards science. If you consider that the dissemination of knowledge is based around peer review and publications sit at the basis of that, then the only real way you can demonstrate that you have achieved this work, or you can show your expertise, is through your publication record. And so this is why the publication record sits really alongside your career achievements and really underpins them. And this is why publications have so much focus, both in dissemination of knowledge and for our own ability to show that we have expertise in a particular subject or topic.
Yes, absolutely, Sasha. As you mentioned before, publishing helps to advance your career and, of course, also to share the knowledge. With so many research papers already published, have you noticed any changes in the submission process itself? I mean, looking back, has it generally become more difficult to publish in the sense that there are more requirements? And what is the best way to choose the right journal to publish?
Well, this is a good question, Anina, and you know, it'd be great to have a discussion about this as a young researcher, whether you do feel that it's becoming more difficult to publish. In my opinion, you know, if I reflect on this, I would think that probably not, because if I think back to what it was like to publish, and here I'm showing my age a little bit, but before the online submission process, of course, everything was handled with paper and post, and certainly I think the digital technologies make the process much easier, starting even with word processing to be able to work on papers, edit much easier, and obviously collaborate with your co-authors. That's a significant move forward. And then, of course, once you have the online submission portals, then it's much easier to facilitate both the submission in some ways and the review process. Fundamentally, the requirement for high quality research doesn't change, right? So, and it's never easy to make a paper. So yes. I think this is really important to say. So some of the practicalities of the submission process, the expedited process of review, the ability to have early access of your work as soon as someone has reviewed it, rather than wait for it to be published in a paper issue. These are all advancements that go along with other advancements in society. So I wouldn't say that it's more difficult to publish. I would probably say it's always been difficult to publish and probably continues to be difficult to publish. But that's, you know, what they say, good things require effort. So this still stands true.
Yeah.
So I think your other question about how to choose a journal to publish, well, you know, many, many factors come into this, but I think fundamentally you just need to understand the scope of the journals that you would like to publish in, and you decide on what is really fundamentally the best fit for the work that you have. And then, you know, always you have to have some choices. So you there will be several journals to choose from, and then you can decide from those that fit, I guess, your particular topic. And the nature of your work, you can decide based on prestige and impact factor and standing within the scientific community.
Yeah. So I was just reflecting on what you said, that is actually not more difficult now than in the past, but definitely as you were discussing now, there are so many more journals nowadays. So probably now it's more difficult to choose where to publish, because sometimes researchers can get lost and may not necessarily understand which journal fits better with their work. So you gave also some tips about, you know, looking at the impact factor, maybe, as you said, or looking at the field of interest. And maybe also, I don't know if there are any other advice that you can give us, or you can give, you know, young researchers about where to choose, you know, the type of journal where to publish. Like, for instance, I don't know, how about open access? Is it something that, is it also relevant? Should we aim to publish in open access journals? What is your feeling about that?
Look, that's again, excellent area to an important area to explore. So I guess, you know, if we just go back and consider some of these, what we call metrics and what they tell us and seem to drive our decision-making around where to publish. I mean, if you look at something like impact factor, which is often utilized a lot, it is certainly a significant measure of the quality of a journal. There's no doubt about it, and that's why I guess the higher the impact factor, the more people are attracted to publishing in these journals, because it's seen as a measure of quality, and it is to some extent. But we do need to understand what the impact factor means. It is essentially how often are the papers published in these journals, how often they are cited. It doesn't mean that necessarily all papers cited in these journals are heavily cited. Sometimes the journals, only certain number of papers published in these journals are highly cited, and number of others may not be so highly cited. So this is where you also have to consider your audience and your topic. And also you have to consider the fact that a lot of, a lot of funding bodies in particular are now taking a more nuanced approach towards assessing where you're publishing, in that they are looking for not so much the impact factor of the journal that you published in, but how highly cited your particular paper is. And this is where audience and topic comes into it. So if you publish in a high impact journal, but the audience is not interested in your work and it's not the right topic for that journal, maybe it will not get the recognition and the impact that you want. So you know, it's many factors that come into it, and impact factor is only one of those. You need to understand what all of these metrics such as impact factor mean. Then we come to the concept of open access. So this is something you have brought up, and should we be publishing in open access? So open access once was very controversial, and now it is a lot less so. There's no doubt about that. So now it's really considered and accepted that open access is really going to be a part of the way that we will be publishing going forward, or certainly a big part of the way we'll be publishing going forward. So once upon a time, it was really this debate between the traditional model of publishing, the fee for through the subscription method, where basically the user was paying for the right to publish, where the user was you know, the way that the publisher made their profit and out of the process was by selling the subscription, whereas open access is a user pays approach, where the person publishing is paying for the costs of that publication and contributing, I guess, to the profit. So these are the two, the change in paradigm: the traditional subscription process, the reader pays, and the new process, the open access, where the person publishing is paying. So you can debate what is fair and what is not fair. But now most of the traditional providers and publishers are now also going with the open access model. And the open access model, the big advantage, of course, is that once the person that owns the work publishes, then everyone's got access to it, to this work. Whereas with the old subscription model, only the people who paid to gain access to the journal were actually obtaining this information. Now, what you see is also a shift from the funding bodies, especially those that are funded by government essentially that the taxpayer money, that there is a demand from these funding bodies that the information is made open access. And this is what's really driving now the fact that open access will be here to stay. It will be the model that will be preferred, I would say. And it is something we need to get used to and probably embrace.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a very important aspect. And also what you said about the accessibility of research and also kind of a responsibility also from the university to pay for the open access. So I think I was just reflecting because I had another question prepared, but you already answered it perfectly. So, I think that is something, the shift towards open access is something which is very important and probably also in a way the future, I think, how we publish.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a complete change in paradigm, as you correctly explained. But Sasso, I also wanted to ask you a little bit more about the process of peer review. You mentioned it in the very beginning, the importance about this control mechanism in publishing. And the reason I would like to discuss a little bit more about peer review is related to the phenomenon of predatory journals, which is becoming a main concern for the academic community. And so I believe we really need to send a clear message to younger researchers. I'm sure we have all received emails in the past by this type of journals that urge us to submit articles and promise their almost immediate publication. But we definitely need to be careful because the only goal of such predatory journals is profit. There is no doubt about that. And they attempt to deceive authors to publish for a fee without providing this robust peer review or any type of editorial services. And therefore, they put profit over trustworthy and dependable science. So what do you think about this? Can you maybe elaborate a little bit and discuss with us why it is so crucial that our work is properly peer reviewed?
Yes, so as I said earlier, Eleanor, I think the peer review process really has been underpinning the scientific exchange process for decades, if not longer, if not centuries. So this has really been shown to be the most effective way to disseminate knowledge, is to have it assessed by your peers, by experts in the field, and so that you can get appropriate feedback, so that firstly the quality and the validity can be validated and can be assessed appropriately, and secondly you can get feedback and opportunities to improve your work. So I think that's now without doubt, it's even though it's a very traditional approach, it's been shown to be effective, not foolproof, but very, very effective and served us very, very well. But it has to be authentic. It has to be done in the proper way. And you need to have high quality, dedicated reviewers who know this topic and are prepared to spend the time and effort to do a thorough review. And I guess this is what the top journals pride themselves on, is that they do have this pool of reviewers and they have the commitment of the reviewers to be able to achieve that, and hence the work that is presented in these journals is of a very high standard. Now, you know, alongside this then sits this open access paradigm, right, which links us to the predatory journals. I mean, the predatory journals were actually probably the first ones that almost introduced the open access concept. In fact, most of the open access only journals were considered to be predatory in a lot of ways, were predatory, because essentially they work on this concept of the researcher pays to have their work disseminated. And what people always think at the very beginning in particular is that if you have to pay to have your work disseminated, then you know, there's probably something not quite right there in the very beginning, right? So these two things were very much linked, the open access and the predatory journal concept and phenomena. It's probably reducing now and much easier to pick. But you can see how the open access concept based on a user pays approach is open to this type of abuse, if you like, by predatory journals. So then it's very, very important that if you're publishing, you're very, very clear and understand what that journal, what its credentials are. And now these days, it's very, very easy to check this, right, on websites. I mean, some of the websites can be quite deceptive. But if you're not sure, if you're just starting out, ask from your colleagues, ask from your senior colleagues in particular, check these journals, do searches on them, and make sure that they are authentic journals that undertake a thorough peer review process. So while the open access concept has now evolved into one that is favored because it allows the whole community and even the public to access your research for free. So that's the attraction. You know, we also have to remember some of the shadier, origins of the open access concept and still be on our toes to make sure that we are publishing open access in high quality journals, which most high quality journals now facilitate. So, I think we can publish open access in high quality journals with appropriate peer review, but we must make sure that we have the right journals.
Yes, absolutely. And thanks that you highlighted it again for the importance about the peer review and also open access. And, you know, when I publish or when I submit my manuscript and then I wait for the peer review, I have a question directly to you because you also are a peer reviewer, and maybe you can give us some insights. What are you looking at the paper when you're reviewing? And maybe you can say or reflect something about the pitfalls and the things we have to avoid when we submit our paper.
Yes, look, that's a very important topic, and having a properly presented manuscript is really essential to have a good chance of a publication. So what does that mean? I mean, I think it's important that the structure is right. And we are all fortunate these days that there is quite a lot of guidance from various societies about different type of paper categories and how they should be structured. From in vitro studies to observational clinical trials to cohort trials to randomized control clinical trials, there is guidelines around this. So one, especially when you're starting, you can look for those guidelines. But what do they all focus on? I would say, you know, the right structure, the readability, a clear hypothesis and aims, the correct study design, and the interpretation of the data. But I would go back and maybe just a step back and maybe we can just focus on what are really the key issues. When you're really thinking about a paper, either reviewing it or writing a paper, I would probably say three things would be essential. One is novelty. Is this new? Then is it done correctly? Is it done well? And then really this speaks to is this information true? Mm-hmm. And then thirdly, is it relevant? Is it going to be important? Is it going to make an impact? So I think those are the sort of three things that I think are really quite important to consider. The novelty, you know, the authenticity of the data design, it being done correctly, and then the relevance, because you really need all of those three things ideally to have a good paper. If any of those are not fulfilled, I think you probably have, you know, potentially an okay paper, but not a great paper.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Sasso, sometimes I'm thinking, I don't know, looking at what is published, that there is this tendency of having more and more reviews, especially for young researchers, because you know that your career progression sometimes depends on how much you publish. You tend to publish a lot of review articles instead of original research, because obviously it takes so much more time to run a clinical trial and get it published. But what are the pitfalls and what are the advantages of this type of approach?
Well, look, the pitfalls are self-evident almost, that if you are someone that's exclusively publishing reviews, then I think ultimately when your track record and expertise is evaluated or assessed, then reputationally this is not going to be great. So I think one has to be very, very careful. And in my view, you know, reviews can be very valuable. And for a young researcher, literature review when they're starting on a topic is very important. Hopefully your topic is novel enough, or at least you've chosen an aspect of a field or a topic that's very novel, and you can make a meaningful contribution to the literature with a well-written scoping review, or even in some cases a systematic review. So not saying that there is no role for reviews, but that's one literature review. And then I guess as a young researcher, you've got to start making your body of work of original work. Because if you keep doing reviews, and the reviews again can be very, very useful, but the issue is when you're first starting out, you don't have the knowledge and the ability to critically appraise the literature, which is really the hallmark of a great review. And the second hallmark is the ability to speculate and guide in relation to where a field is heading, the direction of a particular topic or field. So young researchers don't really have the depth of knowledge. They don't have the experience and to really fulfill this criteria for what is a highly impactful and a major significant review. How do you develop that knowledge? Well, you develop it by doing the original work and by contributing to the original data. So it's partly an understanding that at the end of the day, it is the research, the original research that drives knowledge, because without this, you can't have reviews, you can't move the field forward. But also the aspect that in terms of building your capacity and knowledge and experience and expertise in research more generally, you need to be undertaking original research. You cannot achieve that just by continually doing reviews. And I think most people will see through that. So those are the pitfalls. The advantages, well, you mentioned those, that in some ways, yes, often reviews can be more highly cited in some cases. And yeah, that's where they do have a role, but they cannot, especially when you're first starting out, form the majority of your publication profile.
Yeah, I think you need a good balance, isn't it? Yes, you cannot just publish one or the other.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. That's absolutely true. They both have roles. But, you know, again, original research is the fundamental building block for our scientific knowledge.
Yeah. So I think everybody is now very motivated to write, to publish.
So, especially during COVID, where we had a lot of time sitting around. and not being able to go into the lab.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everyone opened their drawers and published whatever was there.
That's right.
Elena, I think you gave us a lot of information about this topic, and especially why we should publish. So thank you very much for that, and that you also were our guest today. And yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed that discussion and really appreciate the opportunity again to speak on again what is a very, very important topic.
Yeah. Thank you also from my side. Really, it was very nice talking to you as always. And you gave us food for thoughts and nice tips, I think, for all of us we can reflect on. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you both. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.